Hello everyone. Today I'm going to be looking at Guillaume Fay. And even though in this series I've generally been looking at people's 10 core ideas, today I'm taking a little bit of a departure. I'm only really looking at Guillaume Fay's ideas in one book of his, which is called Sex and Deviance. Now, Sex and Deviance has become a little bit difficult to find. Guillaume Fay died in 2019, and unfortunately, it seems that his books, for whatever reason, have fallen out of print. Now, I picked up my copy of Sex and Deviance back in 2023. It is now 3 years later, and just looking around on the internet, it doesn't seem to be available. I know his publisher is Arctos. If anybody from Arctos is watching, what's going on? Why can't you get hold of Guillaume Fay's books anymore? But anyway, the reason I mention this is because Guillaume Fay was perhaps better known for his work on race, and specifically race relations in France. Fay was associated with a movement known as the French New Right, which has been somewhat influential in French politics, especially with the rise of Marine Le Pen and populist forces. Not that any of the New Right thinkers were populist, they were more sophisticated than that. And Guillaume Fay is associated with that. And if anybody knows him, it's probably for his books where he predicts, among other things, you know, the coming of a race war in France. I'm not going to be talking about that side of his work today. I am mainly going to be talking about Sex and Deviance. Unfortunately, I cannot find my copy. It's probably worth a pretty penny now, my copy of Sex and Deviance, but I can't find it. Maybe I've left it at home. It's not here at the lodge. I would encourage you to try to find a copy if you can't. And I encourage Arctos to re-release it. Why is it out of print? Anyway, let's get on now to Fay's core ideas. Now, this comes on the heels of the video on F. Roger Devlin, which I looked at yesterday, and on J.D. Unwin, which was the day before. Fay, I would say, is perhaps even more realist than those two, which is to say that there's a tendency of people like Unwin and to some extent Devlin, when they're talking about old form, to idealize them, dare I say, or to speak as if, in the past when, let's say, sex before marriage was prohibited, that meant, you know, that the rule was stuck by, you know, no matter what. Whereas, of course, the reality is not quite as clear cut as that. All you'd need to do is read Shakespeare's Measure for Measure to know that actually, you know, the reality is that people were, you know, people did have sex before marriage, right, sometimes. And Guillaume Fay is pretty good at navigating the distance between the ideal, you know, the thing that is held up as the ideal that we should be aiming for, and actually what the reality was on the ground in the past, but also why it was that the past and the way things were done in the past led to better outcomes than the disaster that has followed the sexual revolution. Broadly speaking, Fay agrees with Unwin and with Devlin. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I would recommend you stop this one, go back and watch those previous two lectures, because this one will mean more, because in some sense, Fay is in dialogue with them. Before I get going, I'll remind everyone, pick up a course at the Academic Agency. It's promo code Scorcher. This is the last time this year I'm going to play the ad, because it's the end of the summer sale. You've got up until the end of July, and I believe when this video goes out, it will be the 30th of July. When you watch this, you've got one day left to take advantage of promo code Scorcher. Buy it now. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. Scorcher. Scorcher.
promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now.
All right, so let's get on to Faye and sex and deviance. So his first argument is that sexuality is a civilizational foundation. Sexual norms are not a private or a peripheral matter. Modern people have a habit of saying, look, whatever goes on in your bedroom is none of my concern. Actually, Faye is saying it is everybody's concern because it is absolutely central to what a civilization is. These govern the reproduction of people in general, which promulgates the human race, or, you know, the French people, say, in Faye's case. And so if that's not going well, that's the concern of everybody. It governs family structure and the transmission of biological and cultural heritage. It determines, in Faye's view, the long-term survival of a people. Deviations from what he terms realistic norms produce measurable social and demographic pathology. The erotic is, in this framework, irreducibly political. So that's Faye basically kind of giving a shot across the bows at all the libertarians. Okay, at all the libertarians. Actually, it's a private matter. It's not, says Faye. It's a matter for the survival of my people, he says. His people, in this case, being the people of the French nation, because Faye was a French patriot. Let's just put it that way. The collapse of the stable couple. Faye contends that the durable monogamous couple, historically the nucleus of social organization, has been supplanted by what he terms molecular or fragile short-term arrangements. The consequences, he argues, are structural. The family breaks down. There is demographic decline. That's the collapsing birth rate, weakened intergenerational bonds, and a widening of social fragmentation across Western societies. And here we see the traditional model. It's not just the nucleus of the family. It's the grandparents and the extended family as well. Do you remember the old saying, it takes a village to raise a child? Well, now this unit is becoming ever more smaller and the support mechanisms are being ever more taken away. In the modern model, you have broken families. You have, you know, messy arrangements where the parents have been through one or two divorces. You know, there are kids from multiple different arrangements coming to live under the same roof in some cases, or there are no kids, or, you know, there's no father, or there's no mother in some cases. Suboptimal for Faye. You know, short-term relationships, family breakdown, demographic decline, social fragmentation. One of the things that, before we get to that, actually, traditional norms, and this is a very important point, were practical and not sentimental. Right? These days, we tend to think of love as a sentimental thing. Marriage between a man and woman being a romantic thing. Actually, it's a practical arrangement. There was a family interest. Material arrangements were structured around the continuity of the family unit, economic stability, social solidarity, rather than the emotional satisfaction of the individuals involved. Now, in some parts of the world, and even, you know, even in the East, these practices are declining. Okay, but once upon a time, if a young man and woman wanted to get together, their families would meet. And the families would have to be happy that this young man was going to be a fit for their family, and the other family would have to be fit that the young woman was going to be a fit for their family, that he or she came from the right background, that he or she had the right values, that he or she was going to, you know, not pull their child into, you know, a dissatisfactory set of arrangements. And the aim was stability. The aim was the promulgation of future offspring in a safe and stable environment. This meant that duty was the predominant thing, not feeling. The normative ideal of monogamy and reproduction oriented behavior more effectively than modern individualism, even when accompanied by acknowledged practical hypocrisies. And I'll get to that in a second. How many times and how many newspaper articles have you read of a man or a woman saying, well, I'm not happy. I'm not happy in this relationship. It's not giving me all the things I've dread about and dreamed about and all the things I want. Therefore, I want to have a divorce. Therefore, I'm going to walk away from my sacred vows. Now, I can't really talk because I am someone who, for my sins, have actually gone through a divorce in my past. So, you know, I got remarried. So I'm on my second marriage. So I cannot speak from the point of view of kind of being a moral arbiter. I have not led by example. I am, in fact, a man of my time. You know, grew up as a teenager in the 90s. I'm a product of this era, and I've fallen into all the traps that Faye has talked about. Okay, I put my own individualism, my own feelings, my own, rather than trying to make it work, I had a divorce. You know, it is where it is. So one of the things that used to predominate was that, well, you wouldn't, like, even if you weren't personally satisfied or personally happy or personally, like, that's less important than your sacred duty to this oath that you've taken. That was why a divorce was a taboo once upon a time. That is why people stay together even if they weren't quote unquote happy, and somehow they made it work, and somehow a kind of different type of love would develop over time. This ideal was pro-social, Faye argues. Even imperfectly absorbed norms pointed society towards a coherent pro-social direction, something that the modern emotional framework conspicuously fails to provide. The modern arrangement is not pro-social because everybody's putting themselves above the society, above the collective, above, you know, they're just putting their own needs and wants first. Me, me, me. The hypocrisies that Faye is talking about here, or that I have in mind when I wrote this slide, is that Faye says, like, look, you've got to understand that when we said there was no sex before marriage, yeah, they're kind of, we, not everybody stuck to that. For example, I'll never forget in Sex and Deviance, he says, in France, look, you know, in France, you're going to tell young men they're not going to sleep before they, you know, all right, JD and win, and all right, it's the ideal. But practically speaking, that didn't always happen. And he said in France, they actually ritualized it. There was a rite of passage for the young groom before he got married to, quote unquote, sleep with an old aunt. Okay, now that wasn't actually an aunt. This was a woman in her 40s. Who would kind of, on the eve of the marriage, take the young groom and kind of take his virginity, or give him one night, give one night ride, something like this, okay? And Faye said this was a kind of rite of passage. Now, that was not written down in any laws. That was not talked about or kind of openly acknowledged, but it was something that went on and something that kind of, you know, was a kind of informal folk custom that was kept going in the villages and towns all across France for many, many, many years. And it was still, when he was a boy, it was still kind of going on, okay? And he was saying, like, look, everybody kind of knew, even though it wasn't written down, this went on, and everybody knew it. Everybody knew this sort of thing went on. The fact is, the ideal is still there. Okay, so even if human beings cannot quite live up to the ideal, you're still reaching for it, okay? You're still reaching for it, despite these little hypocrisies like that, you know, that old French custom that he was talking about. And in fact, the little customs and the little hypocrisies actually make it a more practical, you know, they are developed for practical reasons, right? For practical reasons. Okay, I think the thinking with the one is, look, you know, you want to get in there with a little bit of experience on the night of your wedding. For example, if you've been there once already, you get in there with a little bit of experience, okay? Or whatever, you know, to know what to do. Being shown the ropes by some old maid, okay? Now, whatever the actual reasons for it, and this would also include things like, you know, what's the oldest profession? Prostitution. You know, well, did the authorities know it was going on? Was it? And, you know, I mentioned in the F. Roger Devlin interview, Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. And in a way, and I talk about that play in this book, Foundations of Shakespeare, which is, well, on the shelf. It's a lovely book. But in there, I talk about this play, Measure for Measure, where Shakespeare actually shows what would happen if the authorities actually started to truly clamp, right? So what happens in Measure for Measure is this guy Angelo comes in and, you know, the Duke goes off on holiday. Actually, he's secretly spying on everybody the whole time. But this guy Angelo comes in and he's very puritanical and he's like, right, any person caught doing sex before marriage, jail and execution. Any person caught using a prostitute, dead. I will execute. Things have got too lax here. I'm going to lay down the law. And in that play, as depicted by Shakespeare, who, let's not forget, was writing in the 1590s and early 1600s, Measure for Measure, I think, early 1600s. It was a early Jacobean play. There's so anyway, this guy, this pimp, basically says, like, look, if you were to take the head of every person in this city who has either used a prostitute or has had sex before marriage, there's not going to be anybody left. You're basically going to kill everyone here. I mean, this is impractical, Angelo. This is just stupid. So anyway, this is one of the acknowledgements that Fay is making here, that, you know, these old societies, they had what was on the books, they had the law, but was it perfect? Did it go strictly, you know, were the, you know, was if somebody did have sex before marriage, was it truly like really strictly enforced in that way? Maybe not as much as J.D. Unwin would like, right, for his thesis to work, but the fact is, it was still there as a norm, as an ideal, something that was upheld as morally normative, even though, you know, maybe old Mr. Jones down the street occasionally went and visited a stripper or whatever, okay? Romantic love is a fragile foundation. Now, this is one of Fay's key insights and what makes this book, Sex and Deviance, particularly strong, I think. He says, modern romantic love is sentimental. It is unstable and it is poorly suited as the primary basis for long-term unions. I talked about Shakespeare. Well, in Shakespeare, romantic love of this kind was seen as being kind of juvenile, adolescent, fickle. It's the love that you see in Midsummer Night's Dream or in Romeo and Juliet. These are young teenage couples. It kind of lacks that kind of practical element because it's just being driven by emotion, okay? Fay argues that the primacy of individual feeling and personal fulfillment over duty has systematically eroded the conditions necessary for stable family formation. Actually, the family unit was not sentimental. It was not driven by things like lust or emotions or falling head over heels in love or whatever the latest Hollywood movie wants to sell you or the rom-com or the, you know, the slop postcard or the love song on the radio. This is all sentimental garbage. You can't build a civilization on that. The civilization is built on practical concerns. The result is a high dissolution rate, because if the basis of the relationship is that, oh, well, I've chosen him because, he said I had nice eyes. And I chose her because I kind of liked the look of her backside. Is that the basis of a stable relationship? Maybe, maybe not. Often not. And if you look at divorce rates and if you look at the rates of people staying together, often not. And it can be destructive, as I've learned to my own detriment. You know, when I was romantic when I was a younger man, bowled over by these sorts of ideas of what love is. Well, the truth of the matter is that any relationship goes through different stages. And in Shakespeare's time, they were very cognizant of this. There were different stages of life, seven ages of man, as he says in As You Like It. Can't really see it when you're young, but when you get older, you start to develop a feel for more practical considerations, not just purely emotional thinking. And, you know, in the old arrangements, well, of course, the families of the two young lovers would know this. They would ask all these sorts of questions, which is why it was a code and a convention. Okay, now it exists in bastardized form of, you have to ask the father's permission to marry the bride. Okay, now it's just kind of done as a formality and as a kind of nod to the past and things like that. But this actually was a very serious idea. They would absolutely have to have the blessing of the parents and of the family. And again, it is sold to us as an idea that love does not know class. Love does not know any boundaries at all. So why can't the guy from the aristocratic background go out with the maid, for example? Why can't that happen? Well, I mean, there are people who I have known about. So when I was growing up, there was a woman who was very old. Okay, she was in her 90s when I was a kid, like really very old, but she was very rich. She was from a kind of a good background, right? Her son married the maid, and she did not talk to her son ever again, to the point where she never met her grandkids. Okay, now this is quite an extreme case of the old school. Okay, and you could say, well, what a silly and bigoted and bitter old woman. Okay, that would be our modern way of thinking about it. What if if the son loved the maid, well, who is she to get in the way? But the point is here, if you have a look at the success rates of love between people from different backgrounds, for example, or different class backgrounds, it does actually lead to tension, because those two people have different values. They've been brought up with different values. Those two people have different ways of seeing things. And it means that they're more likely not to see eye to eye on a whole host of issues, okay, which can lead to the breakdown of the relationship and eventually the marriage. Okay. And again, it's modern hubris that says, no, we know better than this. Well, actually, through the experience of hundreds of years, the experience of generations upon generations on generations of people say, actually, it doesn't work if you do it that way. We've seen what happens if, the gentleman goes out with the maid, or, you know, if you mix and match in this way and that way, it actually leads to more problems. So, I would say my neighbor went too far there. But the reason that she had that prejudice, to come back to Michael Oakeshott a couple of weeks back, we were talking about, the inherited wisdom, the wisdom that she was inheriting there is that actually these sorts of relationships lead to trouble. They don't last, or they lead to complications down the line. And in many cases, it's the family saying, well, you know, we're just looking out for you, really, to not get into these sorts of scrapes. Modern narcissism, modern individualism says, who are you to get in the way? I love him. Et cetera, et cetera. This is the tension. And Faye is saying, like, you know, the going completely over to this side of things has actually, you know, led to very predictable outcomes, very predictable outcomes. He says that this situation has led to a de-virilization and erosion of masculine identity. Faye identifies a widespread de-virilization of men across contemporary Western societies. This, we're back to Otto Weininger, the spiritual women, remember? The erosion of male authority, the protective instinct, and what he terms virility, alongside the corresponding elevation of feminine values in public and institutional life. He regards the shift as a civilizational liability, weakening social order and collective confidence in self-perpetuation. And, you know, to give an idea of what he's talking about, you know, I see many examples of men actually embodying what Weininger called the female principle, emotionalism, you know, responding only in the moment rather than being able to abstract, right? So you use abstract reasoning and cognitive functioning and many, 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 many other ways in which the modern man actually becomes a kind of spiritual woman when looked at in this way. There's been an erosion of authority, okay? The culture and the law has delegitimized the traditional male protective and ordering roles and has actually neutered the father in the family, according to Faye. Institutional feminization elevates feminine values in governance, in education, in media. You know, I mean, one of the things Faye gets into is using kind of female learning styles in school. Well, that may work for women, but it doesn't always work for men. I mean, an example I would give is the therapy culture. Okay, I've talked about this before. Now, men have issues and women have issues, but they process them differently. Women like to talk through their issues in order to process them. Men do not always want to share those feelings. They all feel them, but they want to process them in a different way. Men like to feel empowered through action. They like to take steps towards a solution. So the way to help, if you ever notice this, the most successful men who help other men provide them with a five-step solution process, something like that. They give them practical steps to help them feel empowered themselves. Whereas the female style says, oh, well, let's talk about it. Let's share your feelings and things like that. Well, a lot of men, they don't like that, does not play into their cognitive style. It doesn't always help them. And in fact, recently there have been studies suggesting that therapy culture can actually lead to worse outcomes for men rather than better outcomes for men because it's a kind of female cognitive style. So, yeah, that is, you know, an important point. And it's across the board. It's in government, it's in education, it's in stuff like therapy, and it's in media. You know, civilizational consequences also then come because we have reduced social cohesion and reduced collective confidence. Biological and sex differences are real. Okay, there are innate differences, according to Guillaume Fay, between men and women. Genuine, complex differences in psychology, in behavior, in reproductive strategy. And these are real. They are biologically rooted. They are psychologically rooted, not socially constructed artifacts. You know, you could have a whole generation of attempts at brainwashing men to be like women, or trying to brainwash women to be like men, and yet they still will default to the default state. And there's an argument to say that with the backlash against feminism that young men everywhere, the Zoomer generation, are currently leading, okay, which is causing a crisis, right? A crisis. These things could have been predicted if the powers that be were listening to people like Guillaume Fay. The powers that be did not listen to Guillaume Fay. They said he was a horrible, racist, sexist bigot, is what they did during his lifetime. But Fay would have said this backlash is entirely predictable. Why? Because guess what? Sex and biology is real. The dialectics of domination, denying these differences in the name of egalitarianism, produces what Fay calls the dialectics of double domination, an inversion of healthy sexual polarity that harms both men and women. The women don't have better outcomes either. And if you want to explore that more, go back to the F. Roger Devlin video that I looked up. There's also a realistic recognition in Fay that insists that a functioning social order must acknowledge these differences openly rather than suppressing them through ideological compulsion. The more, okay, and I've seen this in my own lifetime, right? Because I remember the 90s. And in the 90s, Blur and Girls and Boys and so on, and the Ladette and Spice Girls and all of that, I think men and women, in a strange way, were closer then, right? They were felt closer then in terms of, like, quote-unquote quality, or just being the, like, being similar. I think that they felt closer then than they do in the current era, because in the intervening 30 odd years we've had this real push of this kind of quite radical and hardcore feminist agenda on everybody, and the more they push and the more they try to deny these real forces, the more they bubble up, the more they resist, the more they kind of burst out. And now it's bursting out in a kind of way that they can no longer control. And this is also the story of, you know, Manosphere and Andrew Tate and the sex wars and gender wars and all the rest of it. Okay, we're seeing a kind of bifurcation of the cognitive styles of male and female, okay, across the board. This is actually not a great outcome in my view. Feminism has internal contradictions. He says, Fay wants to say, like, look, feminism historically had legitimate demands for formal legal equality, for example. And there's a difference between that, okay, like, well, women should have the right to vote. Women should have the right to do any job they want, blah, 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 to this later ideological trajectory. In its contemporary form, according to Fay, feminism denies biological sex differences, promotes an androgynous ideal, and ultimately harms women by pressing them towards masculinization. Now, what's very interesting is that Fay was making this point in 2014. Otto Weininger was making it all the way back in 1902. So, you know, it's kind of like, I wonder if there was such a difference between the two, the old feminism and the... Maybe Fay was just trying to be a bit, maybe he was just trying not to open up. He was trying to delimitate his own argument. But looking back on Weininger, I wonder, because Weininger just said the same thing, basically, that feminists were trying to push women into masculine roles. This process dismantles family structures that empirically most women continue to rely upon. Fay is against the sacralization of homosexuality and gender ideology, now known ubiquitously as LGBT. Fay argues that the elevation of homosexuality and gender theory into inviolable ideological values constitutes an excess that pathologizes normal heterosexuality and promotes arrangements contrary to reproductive norms and deepens the broader denial of biological reality. And you can fill in the gaps there yourself. The concern is civilizational, the normalization of arrangements that at scale cannot sustain demographic continuity. What he means is, you know, if everybody, right, if it, let's just say half of all people become LGBT, that's half of everybody out of the reproductive gamut, unless you then turn en masse to, you know, surrogate situations or, you know, but let's face it, that's or adoption or things like that. But let's face it, that is not sustainable, right, or realistic in any single respect. So this is the basic point that Faye is making. Sexual liberation as a form of disorder. The promise of sexual liberation was the removal of traditional sexual restraints presented as liberation from repressions and the path to authentic fulfillment. The reality has been the alienation, relational anxiety, and commodification of sex, alongside demographic decline and chronic instability at a microcosmic level of the family and at the macrocosmic level of society at large. Fay contends in his final assessment that the outcome is a disordered, erotic culture producing measurable social and civilizational costs. Fay says that if we're ever going to get out of this hole, we need to forge a path towards a new, more realistic order. Civilizational recovery demands a clear-eyed return to the recognition of biological sex differences, durable family structures, and norms that prioritize reproduction and social continuity. Now, if we were cast our minds back to J.D. Unwin, that is easier said than done. Unwin said, like, once the genie's out of the bottle, could take a long time to get back. Traditional ideals were never perfectly realized, says Fay. Okay, they were never truly lived up to the ideal. There was always the old maid or whatever it was going on behind, you know, down in the basement. However, Fay argues that the old ways, even though they weren't perfect, channeled human nature far more successfully than the contemporary inversion of them, however imperfect their historical expression. So Fay is saying that if there's going to be a hope for France, his beloved France, or indeed if there's going to be a hope for Britain or America or the West more broadly, this situation has to be sorted out sooner rather than later. Now, he wrote that book in 2014. It is now 12 years later, and he's no longer with us. It's 2026. Are we any closer? The answer is no. The answer is no. And for all of the noise around Donald Trump and populist forces, I don't see that many steps. Maybe Giorgia Meloni in Italy has made some steps towards the old arrangements again, but very few steps. Certainly here in this country, it doesn't even seem to be on the political agenda. So, you know, from Faye's point of view, the future is looking pretty bleak when it comes to these sorts of things. If you enjoy this, I've got many, many other lectures here in the Great Thinkers series. Check it out. I have educational courses that you can pick up at the academic agency. It's promo code Scorcher at the moment. It's your last chance to take advantage of that sale, 25% off. There won't be another sale now until we reach kind of Halloween bonfire night sort of time, which is quite a ways off from now. So pick it up today. And I'll catch you all next time. Bye, everyone. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.